You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggles for love and revolution.
This week on Love and Revolution Radio, we interview Marie Principe about her new research on women and nonviolent movements. We explore traditional and non-traditional gender roles, the dynamics of nonviolent struggle, and what it all means for our own movements at this time.
Well, I think the greatest takeaway is that there's enormous power that lies in groups that are often underestimated. And this isn't just true for women, but I think for a lot of groups, and I think that it's a call to action for us to pay attention to peoples and identities that the media might not be showing us, whether it be in the U.S. or elsewhere. You know, are there groups that are typically underestimated or typically overlooked?
Hello, this is Sherry Mitchell for Love and Revolution Radio. Kwe and Egwanu, welcome. I'm coming to you from my home in the Dawn Land, back from an incredibly sad and traumatic experience with my family. I'd like to thank all of our listeners and the followers of my Facebook page who have sent me condolences and lots of words of love and support. It's been a great deal to me to have that love and support along the way, and I don't think that I could have gotten through the past week without all of you. So, Kachi Williwan, thank you so much from my heart. I appreciate you all. Today, I'm joined by my wonderful co-host, Miss Rivera Sun, and we have a very special show on tap for you today. Hello, Rivera.
Greetings, Sherry, and we certainly have been keeping you and your family in our hearts at this end of the universe. And there is a lot going on in our world as well as in our personal lives. And one thing I'm seeing more and more long-term, in-depth, on-the-ground activists and organizers talking about is the need for this kind of support and solidarity that you were just thanking people for showing for the human aspects of our lives, not just the organizer end of the hats that we wear, that we are human beings in this work. And that's actually what makes us so beautiful and powerful at the same time. In an interesting way, that is really the theme of today's show. We're going to speak with Marie Principe, who is currently the Program Associate for the Women in Public Service Project and Global Women's Leadership Initiative at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Her broader research throughout her life focuses on the ways that conflict and political instability affects women, particularly in the Middle East and North Africa. But she's gone on another line of inquiry, which we're very happy to have heard about, which is to investigate women in nonviolent movements. Now, as you listeners can guess, Sherry and I are both very intrigued to hear what the research end of this lived reality that we embody has come up with in terms of dynamics and trends and kind of perspectives that we can learn from. So Marie, thank you for joining us on the show and for sharing what you've discovered with us.
Great. Thank you. Thank you both for having me. It's a pleasure to be a part of this.
Marie, we're just wanting to jump right into the subject matter here. And first off, I'm really interested in learning, what was it that precipitated the study? What were you looking for when you set off on this track, and what did you end up finding?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, starting off, it's really interesting now to see how the timing has sort of worked out, with the Women's March being one of the biggest acts of civil resistance that we've seen in the States, at least in the last few years. And I think, if I remember correctly, reading somewhere that one of the largest in quite a while. So, you know, and that was purely accidental, which has been really interesting because I think that sort of garnered more interest in the subject. So my work has mostly been in the Middle East over the last 10 years or so. It's just been focused there. And before I started looking at women in nonviolent movements, I was actually quite interested in women in terrorist organizations. And when I was in grad school, focused on why women join armed groups that violate their own rights. And, you know, at the time there was, you know, and even still continuing, but particularly then when I was looking at this research a few years ago, that was when you saw alarming rates of women joining ISIS and serving in different roles. And so I was really fascinated by the motivational steps that bring women into these groups and how this radicalization happens and how they target men and women differently. And so this idea of like women and political instability and how women are brought into the fore on things differently than men has always been of interest, and definitely more so in the last couple of years. And so this really came up sort of organically, because I am just by nature, I like to look at both sides of things. I'm probably overly analytical and want to know, okay, well, if it's happening in the violent sphere, what's going on in the nonviolent sphere? And had a great friend and contact who I believe has been on your show before, Maria Stephan, at the U.S. Institute of Peace. And she's an expert in civil resistance, and I've known her work for a long time. So it felt very organic for us to sort of combine forces and find out how we can talk about this issue of women and nonviolent movements and what's, you know, what historically we've seen, and the timing just ended up working out that now there is more of a focus on that, especially in the U.S.
You know, we haven't actually had Maria on the show yet, although we want to, so we got to put the bug in her ear about that. We have had Erica Chenoweth on the Occupy Radio program that preceded this radio show, and we would like to get her back as well. Now, since we're on the subject of Maria and Erica, we should bring up Why Civil Resistance Works, the title of their book, which framed the groundbreaking research they did on comparing violent and nonviolent conflicts. Now, you also cite this research in your recent study that you put out about women in nonviolent movements, speaking a little bit about why the things that they discovered in the general context of nonviolent civil resistance have an import and an impact upon understanding women's roles in movements. Would you discuss a little bit the significance of particularly the dynamic of mass participation and how that plays out with women in nonviolent movements?
Sure. So just to sort of recap some of their major findings, which I think are, I mean, every time I say that, it's sort of mind-boggling. So they looked at 323 violent and nonviolent campaigns from 1900 to 2006. And they found that the nonviolent campaigns attract 11 times more participants than armed movements. And that along with that, the nonviolent tactics, the movements that had nonviolent tactics, met their stated objectives 54% of the time compared to 26% for the armed campaigns. So this idea of greater participation, the nonviolent movements allow for greater participation, and that is one of the huge factors that can lead to success. And part of this is because the barriers for participation in nonviolent movements are substantially less than in armed movements. I mean, everything from the type of physique that you need to have to be in a nonviolent movement versus an armed movement, the age range. I mean, usually in armed movements, you typically see men, you typically see younger. You know, they're able to carry a weapon. They have to be evading security forces, and so they're moving around a lot. And they might be moving in terms of like hiding in you know, in one city, or they may be traveling across a country. And so that kind of flexibility is usually not afforded to the majority of a population. And so what you find is that there are a lot more people who are willing to be a part of nonviolent movements because the barriers for their participation are lower. They can engage on a more minor level by being a social media activist. They can go out in the streets. They can make signs. And usually the commitment is not as severe, and the ramifications and backlash may not be as serious as being a part of an armed movement, which is typically illegal and can result in, you know, jail time and sometimes far worse if you're caught. So I think that this aspect of participation is so incredibly important. And then what you see is that it also allows for more women to be involved. And just about in every country, women are 50% of the population. And so these mass movements that catch our attention when you see the protests in Maidan, where women were absolutely critical in Maidan in the Ukraine a couple of years ago, you see men and women together. When you see the protests fighting against Mubarak's regime in 2011, you see men and women together. You see multiple ages. And that's partly because women tend to be shouldered with different kinds of responsibilities that may make the flexibility that can come with the nonviolent movements much more appealing than violent ones.
I'm struck, having been to Standing Rock at the end of this past year, by your discussion on consequences, that you have very peaceful, nonviolent activists, a number of women standing at Standing Rock, and they did face jail time. They are facing some pretty hefty costs associated with the imposition of trumped up charges on them, and fines and fees and attorney's fees and all of that. Not only that, but there was a lot of physical harm that was experienced by women. One young woman had her arm blown up. Another one lost an eye. The women that were taken into custody were strip searched, some of them left in jail cells overnight without any clothes on. And so we're also seeing a number of states in the country who are trying to pass laws. The conservatives are trying to pass laws that make it illegal to protest nonviolently, even in their areas. And some are attempting to pass laws making it legal for the police to kill nonviolent activists. And in North Dakota, they recently tried to pass a law, still in process, to make it legal for motorists to strike and kill protesters without being charged for manslaughter. And so there is a shift occurring in this country in regard to nonviolent activism. Just because you're engaging nonviolently doesn't mean you're going to be met with nonviolence. We've certainly seen that here in this country, where the police forces, those charged with the protection of people, are now protecting the interests of big business, often at the expense of the people. So with this changing dynamic that's taking place, and the massive uprising of women that we saw with the Women's March, and women becoming more active in many ways across the spectrum, how do you see this changing some of the outcomes that you found within your study?
Yeah, I think that's an important question, because, you know, absolutely, being involved with nonviolent movements, as you said, it doesn't necessarily protect you from violence, and it doesn't protect you against backlash. The best thing that I think can be hoped for, which doesn't really do much except that we could try to translate that into action and policy, is that there tends to be greater backlash against policies that and repercussions that target nonviolent protesters versus those that target armed or violent protesters. So I think that part of it is media coverage is incredibly important. And it's a whole other conversation is what media coverage is like for women and, you know, how the media covers women. And this is not only true for the US. I mean, this is all over the world. And so I think, you know, greater media coverage of the ways that nonviolent protesters are being treated and greater information around that can help to foment more of a backlash than maybe what we're seeing. I still think, I mean, I maybe this is, you know, stupidly optimistic, but, you know, I still think that protesting nonviolently is far and away a better option, despite the backlash that may occur. And I think that that is another reason why, and maybe another aspect of the conversation is more diverse leadership and more women in leadership positions. And, you know, I think that this country is seeing a major shakeup in a lot of ways. And I think there's a cultural shakeup happening that I believe is going to result in a more diverse leadership that includes gender equality at senior posts. And I think with that, you'll see different decisions being made and you'll see different responses to things like nonviolent protests. Now, I don't have data to back that up. I mean, this is sort of a personal hope out of it, but just from the experience that I've had and the research that I've done on the difference that women make in decision making suggests that different decisions are made. And I don't think that it's because of anything inherent to being a woman, but that when there's a certain population that has not been a part of decision making for basically since decisions were being made, that group tends to want to make decisions differently. So I think that with more women in positions of leadership and more diverse leadership, you will see different decisions being made.
Well, I think this conversation around nonviolent movements and repression and the role of women within them opens some really fertile territory. I think it's really good to bring that Sherry brought up the reality of repression within nonviolent movements, and then also to acknowledge the very different levels of repression that people experience based not only on gender, but also class, and then also race and ethnicity as well, that every single one of the isms we can name changes the amount and level of repression that is used and is tolerated as being used towards peaceful protesters or nonviolent actors, as we often call them. But I want to ask you some questions that you brought up in your study about some of those very specific dynamics, because we see women being used in nonviolent movements or showing up in nonviolent movements in very particular ways around the levels of repression or the maintenance of nonviolent discipline. For example, in Argentina, one of your case studies was looking at the role of the mothers on the plaza who were totally underestimated in terms of their political power and allowed to continue their protests, which actually started to open the political space for nonviolent organizing to occur. And then conversely, the other example that you put in your study that came to mind was this, I'm thinking of Serbia, but I'm not sure you actually use Serbia as the example in the study, where women are brought to the forefront of public demonstrations and marches, street demonstrations, anywhere where an encounter with an agent of repression, police or otherwise, could be aggravated by the traditional gender role and dynamic of young men in the front of the line. To replace them with young women would change the dynamic in the streets. So I'm wondering if you would explain, if you would just highlight a few of the dynamics around these men, these because they're complex. They're not straightforward. There's many different angles, but the dynamics around women, repression, and social or genderized norms in the context of a nonviolent movement.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the biggest frustrations and the biggest biggest weapons that women have is that we are often underestimated. And I think that this really is, you know, our greatest power, especially when it comes to political dissent. And I think you see this so much. I mean, in Argentina, it's just a fabulous example that I really love, because these women were completely underestimated. I mean, they were described as the mad women. They were, you know, matronly. They were mostly in their 40s, 50s. Some of them were much older, were grandmothers, and they were wearing white scarves that had their names of their children embroidered on them. And they, you know, they were marching in the plaza. And meanwhile, the Argentine government had been kidnapping thousands and thousands of dissidents who they thought were the real threats to their regime. And they were mostly younger, and they were men and women that they were kidnapping and resulting in their disappearance. And these women were, I mean, for the most part, they were completely underestimated. There were a couple, or a handful, I should say more than a couple, but there were a handful that were kidnapped to try to dissuade the rest of the mothers from protesting, and those women did disappear. They were some of the original founders of it, but that didn't dissuade the rest of them from really, I mean, they organized and came back and were able to really bring down that regime because they had been underestimated. And I think typically what you would probably see if that had been a group of men is the government probably would have opened fire, or they might have tried a couple of other repression tactics first before they opened fire. But they didn't do that with the women because they knew that the backlash for firing on a group of mothers who were just demanding for to know the whereabouts of their children would probably have a much greater backlash for the regime than to not. So I think there's not only the gender dynamic, but there's the age. And then also using the idea of women as mothers, using the mother angle. The women that were protesting in Maidan, all different ages, they were students at first, but then they were mothers and grandmothers who came to Kyiv to protest. And they said that it was their responsibility as mothers to protect their children and to protect their children from the gang, as it was referred to. So I think that there are these very interesting intersections of identities that allow women to either exploit or sort of undermine these traditional notions of where they belong. And they've used it to their advantage and, you know, on more than one occasion. And same with, I'm not sure about Serbia, but I think the example that was in the report is on Palestine. In the West Bank, the film by Julia Baca called Budrus, which featured the women on their own walking to the front to face the Israeli defense forces, because they also assumed and knew that the Israeli forces were less likely to shoot on women who were approaching rather than men, because men are typically seen as much more threatening than women are.
I just am sitting over here trying to wrap my head around the idea of some of the things that you've been talking about. One of the things that strikes me is that we have a number of women that are in power right now in this country, and many of them are firmly aligned with the patriarchy and have simply sought to find themselves a place at that patriarchal table without doing a whole lot to really advance the rights of other women. And so I think that, you know, we need to be really conscious of the fact that when we're talking about promoting women into positions of power, that it's the right women that we're putting forward, that we aren't just putting forward those women who are power brokers, who are seeking their own position within the power structure that exists, that are actually going to be putting forth the needs and the desires of the mothers, and who are going to be acting in a way that protects life, that promotes equality, that provides us with all of the things that the women carry traditionally, which is the nurturers, life givers, life protectors, life sustainers, because we haven't really seen very much of that in the women that have been in positions of power politically within this country. So I just wanted to make note of that, that that's a really important distinction that needs to be made. I also want to talk about, when you're talking about these particular movements, the thing that strikes me about those is that these are populations where there tends to be one race of people within the population. And here in this country, and in some other areas of the world, where there is great diversity within the populations, not all of the women get the same treatment. So we have a huge problem here with violent assault against women of color. We have a huge problem here with disappearing the missing and murdered indigenous women that nobody seems to pay attention to, that Amnesty International and the UN have done reports on to bring to light the fact that these populations of women are disappearing, and they're disappearing in a way where they're invisible to the public eye. And so when we're looking at trying to utilize some of these tactics that you're talking about, where we're promoting groups of women and mothers, do you think that there's a way to do that that honors the diversity that we have and that allows for women who come from marginalized populations to be seen as human beings? Because that certainly has been problematic. It's been something that's been problematic even within the Women's March. There's been a lot of critique about the lack of intersectionality that exists within that movement. And so these are things that we're going to have to address. We're going to have to talk about them out loud in the public sphere if we want to be able to solve these problems once and for all and move forward in a truly unified way where we're actually working towards some form of equality. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if I can, just to clarify, to go back to what you were saying before, I mean, I think you're absolutely right that there are, of course, women who turn out to be bad leaders, just like there are men who turn out to be bad leaders. And I think when we talk about equal opportunity, we also kind of mean equal opportunity to be awful. I mean, there's no guarantee that bringing in more women voices will result in policies that are, you know, there's no guarantee, I should say, that a woman who is in power is necessarily going to represent all women. And I don't think that that should be an expectation that is put on any one person to represent in leadership. that, you know, all of, because that's just, it's not identifying that person as an individual. And in a way, it's still sexist. And so I think,
I just want to clarify that my point wasn't that one person has to represent an entire group. My point was that if we're talking about the advancements of real women's rights, if we're talking about putting people in positions of power that are going to be looking out for the things that you had mentioned, then we have to be selective about the individuals that we put in positions of power to make sure that their position is actually aligned with that. So,
I guess I'm really big on the discourse that happens in our democracy. And I think that, you know, you're talking about, you know, women being life sustainers and all that. And I think that there are a lot of people that are on the pro-life side that would also say that they're life sustainers. And I think it's just a matter of, you know, are we having a healthy, equal debate? Are there as many women who are in leadership who are talking about pro-life as there are who are talking about pro-choice? Because, you know, even though I may personally feel like the policies should reflect a one specific way, I would like there to be an equal discourse and leadership that is having that respectful discourse and coming to a decision that is best for the country based on that. And I think in terms of I absolutely agree that the issue of this intersectionality and, you know, there are a lot of countries that are noted in this report and elsewhere who have enormous diversity in their populations. And, you know, our country is very special in a lot of ways, partly because it's huge. And there is a very complex history when it comes to racial division that a lot of other countries don't have the same history. And most countries just don't have that same history. So I think that the origins of, from what I understand of the march, it sounded like the origins didn't initially honor that diversity. But then from what I saw, the march absolutely, I mean, I wasn't there, but I followed it on the news and was listening to the speeches and the congresswomen who were talking. And, you know, Tammy Duckworth was highlighting the importance of more women's voices. And she is an Asian American. She's a veteran. She's disabled. She's a woman. I mean, she absolutely cuts across this. And then you have Kamala Harris and these other women who were speaking to the issues facing Latina women and facing those within the LGBTQ community and African-American women. I mean, I think that this march, the way I see it, is that it really came to a different endpoint than the way that the origins came about, where it was much more white, middle, upper-class women, I think, were the ones that were initially talking about this march. And so I'd like to see that this is people power. When you have much more people that are a part of that message, it becomes more intersectional just by lending their voices to the initiative. So I think that is what we're going to be seeing more of, because the alternative has been unsustainable, and we've seen that all too harshly.
I think one of the things that's coming up is this idea of means becoming the ends in the making, or means are ends in the making. And the idea that the way we organize and the way we bring people to the table from the very start and the very get-go can be fair and just and inclusive, or it can be unjust and exclusive. And this is a problem that persists in not just traditional political spaces, but in the generally non-traditional political spaces of nonviolent movements as well. One of the things you looked at in your study is that dynamic of the internal leadership and organizational structure and the role of women within that. And we'll be back after a quick break for a station ID and your weekly dose of nonviolence. We know the sweet world is not going to end, because it's always returning. On this week's Nonviolence Minute, we're going to highlight the many nonviolent movements that were organized by or featured women in strong leadership and participatory roles. Women's suffrage and women's rights movements have taken place in nearly every country in the world. These are generally led by women. These movements have been overwhelmingly nonviolent. The history of women-led movements stretches back through time. In 411 BC, a Greek play called Lysistrata by Aristophanes featured a story in which the Greek women refused to have sex with the men until they ended the Peloponnesian War. This play, although fictional, went on to inspire numerous sex strike actions throughout the world for a variety of demands. To name just one example, in 2006, Colombian women held a sex strike against their boyfriends, who were gang members, to reduce gang violence. This very effective action ended up reducing gang violence in Colombia by 26%. Another sex strike action, which was probably not inspired by the play but bears mentioning, is that in 1600, the Iroquois women of North America held a sex strike to gain the power to veto war. They were successful and also gained several other demands in the process. The trend of inspiration and adaptation between one women-led movement to another occurs frequently when we start to look at the history of women's movements and campaigns. For example, the origins of the word treehugger show this pattern. Although the word evokes images of Julia Butterfly Hill's famous two-year tree sit in a redwood tree, the origins go back to India and an action in 1730, when a religious sect called the Bishnois was led into action by Amrita Devi. She threw her arms around the trees of a forest along with other women to save it from being clear-cutted. They were, unfortunately, massacred. However, the king heard about their murders and stopped the logging, putting the entire forest under protection. This later inspired the Chipko movement of the 1970s, when Gwara Devi and 27 women also threw their arms around the trees and stopped the logging operation. Looking back through history, the first recorded women's labor strike happened in 1824 in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. It was called the Mother of All Strikes because it led to a number of women's strikes for labor rights and protections in the workplace. One website says, in subsequent decades, women's labor strikes expanded throughout the world. In the 1880s, women were active in labor organizing and strikes in Mexico. In 1888, the Women's Match Workers of London conducted a strike, often cited as one of the earliest successful strikes. Numerous strikes in the French tobacco industry between 1870 and 1900 featured women workers playing a dominant role. In 1893, the first strike of women workers in Vienna won the textile workers a 10-hour day, a minimum wage, and other demands. In 1904, women textile workers in Crimmitschau, Germany, went on strike for over 22 weeks. In 1909 and 1910, 20,000 to 30,000 women in the shirtwaist industry went on strike in New York and Philadelphia, which became the largest strike of women workers in an event of major importance. Women workers continued to use the strike in many parts of the world in struggles to change the conditions of their lives. Women textile workers in Barcelona, Spain went on strike in 1913. Women metal workers in Brazil in 1980. Women textile workers in Poland in 1981. Women bakery workers in India in 1984. Asian women textile workers in Birmingham, England in 1982. The list actually goes on and on. In 1919, an interesting event happened in Costa Rica when women teachers organized a strike and other actions to protect their jobs and ended up, in the long run, overthrowing the dictatorial Tinoco regime and propelling women's suffrage forward. In 1975, the women of Iceland staged a one-day, very successful strike for economic and social equality. In 2002, Nigerian women occupied a Chevron plant, demanding a number of labor and safety demands. They were successful in winning concessions from the oil company. In 1998 and 1999, there is the famous example of Wangari Maathai and the Greenbelt movement in Kenya that defended and expanded the forest protections. And of course, no summary and short overview of women in nonviolent struggle is complete without mentioning the amazing and astonishing success of the Women of Liberia's Mass Action for Peace in 2003 that not only stopped the Second Liberian Civil War, but also ended up ousting the dictator Charles Taylor. These are just some of the overwhelming number of case studies, actions, campaigns, and movements that have involved women as the major participants and organizers. The list goes on. From Dorothy Day to Sophie Scholl to the Polish women involved in the Solidarity movement to Ella Baker, Septima Clark, Fannie Lou Hamer, Coretta Scott King, and so many more women in the civil rights movement, to the Palestinian women in the First Intifada, to the women involved in and driving the Arab Spring, particularly in Tunisia and Egypt, to the hundreds of examples throughout the world. Knowing the breadth and scope of the role women in nonviolent movements have played is one reason why we say, you must know your nonviolent history. It has already changed your life. And now let's return to our conversation with Maria Principi about women and nonviolent struggle. Across the world, in the examples you were looking at, did you see clear trends or not clear trends around organizational structure, participation of women in the leadership, whatever that might be, of the nonviolent movement, and then the outcomes of the nonviolent movement, like mm-hmm. both the goals and objectives, the tactics and strategies they were choosing, and or the success rate of the struggles? Was there any kind mm-hmm. of knowledge or wisdom that can be gleaned from looking at that?
I think that's a great question. Unfortunately, nothing quantifiable as of yet. I don't think that there has been a method for collecting data yet around where women have served in leadership positions in these nonviolent movements, you know, really comprehensively to offer any sort of analysis around what difference that makes. And it depends. I mean, the Argentine protests were predominantly, if not almost all, women, whereas the Solidarity movement was primarily men who were in the leadership positions in Poland that were fighting against the communist regime in Poland. And it was women who kept it going when the men were arrested and were driven underground. It was the women who kept the momentum and the pressure on the government and kept the newsletter going. You know, and then there was also a woman who ended up being a part of I believe it was the constitutional reforms afterwards. There was a woman who had been in the Solidarity movement. So I think that it depends and is diverse. Interestingly, there was a great bit of research that has been done by Victor Assal, who's a professor at SUNY Albany, that I referenced in the report. And I'd really love for, you know, someone with a quantitative mind, which is not mine, to look at this more deeply. But he was focused on the Middle East and North Africa, and he found that gender-inclusive ideologies can influence a movement's choice to be nonviolent or violent. So he looked at, I think it was about 100 or 110 ethno-political organizations between 1980 and 2004, and he compared the gender-related variables and the choice of the organization to use violence or nonviolence. And what he found was that having an ideology that was gender inclusive and as part of the political agenda had a really strong impact on whether the organization chose violence or nonviolence, and found that mostly the gender inclusive ideologies were more likely to use peaceful tactics. Now, the missing piece on this, I mean, there are a few missing pieces that I would want to know in order to take this all the steps further that I think it could be taken. But I would want to know, you know, what was the leadership within these movements, within these organizations, and how did they come to, well, what does it mean to have a gender inclusive ideology? What does that look like? And how did they come to that decision? So I think that's one of the questions that I would love to see unpacked a little bit further, and sort of explored in this paper, is this hypothesis of, if there are more women involved in a movement, is the movement more likely to choose nonviolence? Ergo, is it more likely to be successful? Because we already know from Maria Steffen and Erica Chenoweth's research that a movement that chooses nonviolence or nonviolent tactics is much more likely to be successful than violent ones. So what difference does having women either involved or in the leadership or in some capacity of decision-making, what outcome does that have?
It'd be really interesting to have that information, and also to see what factors come into play in the way that the movement is strategized, as you said, depending on mm-hmm. who's in leadership roles. And I hope that there's somebody out there that's listening that is inspired to do that, or will connect with somebody who they think may be capable of doing that work. What were some of the things that you found that were most surprising to you as you were doing the study? Were there things that came up that weren't what you were expecting, or that came up that you hadn't considered at all as you were doing the study?
Well, I think one of the major questions that has come up more so in the response to the paper than the research itself is this question that's been lingering on my mind of, okay, well, what happens now that we're drawing attention to the threat that women pose? Now that we're telling people, watch out because we're coming for you. What kind of implications does that have for women? Because if the reason that women have been very successful in tactical innovation and designing strategy for movements is the fact that they are underestimated, what do we do if people start to target women more than they have in the past? And as you mentioned, there is more of that in South Dakota. That's happening. And that doesn't need to come after, you know, gender equality does not have to be a precursor for that to happen. I think that you might start seeing more targeting of women with a greater understanding of the roles that women play. So to be honest, it's something that I'm sort of grappling with, because I don't want anyone to be, you know, under threat as a result of having this conversation. But then I try to remind myself that, you know, I'm not the only voice that's talking about this, so it doesn't really fall on my shoulders per se. But I think it is something to consider. What do we do once we unveil a threat that we didn't think was a threat?
Now, the question that's coming up for me is, we know also from Erica and Maria's work that nonviolent struggle itself is a democratizing force within the society that it takes place in, regardless mm-hmm. of whether it succeeds mm-hmm. or fail. This is one of their surprising findings, that there's more democratic freedoms, more democratic aspects to the society after a nonviolent struggle takes place. The question for you, with a narrow lens of focus around women, is what are the chicken and egg dynamics of women and nonviolent struggle, or women's rights, or women's participation and political power, and the use of nonviolent struggle? You quote Pam McAllister and her writings in your study that basically talk about women's history being actually the story of the development of nonviolent struggle.
Mm-hmm.
You also talk about the difference between struggles for women's rights specifically and the role of women in struggles that are about other kinds of rights or freedoms. Yeah, what are the dynamics around mutual causality, or chicken and egg, or which comes first, that you found in your examination?
Well, I don't know if this will directly target your question, so forgive me and feel free to clarify if it doesn't. But I think what you're trying to get at is something that I learned and didn't know already, is that, you know, a lot of these movements for women's rights came out of larger movements. Lucy Stone, back, you know, pre-women's suffrage, she was a huge anti-slavery proponent. And she, you know, along with Susan B. Anthony and a bunch of other women in America who were lending their voice to the anti-slavery speaking tours, ended up realizing that their voice wasn't as meaningful to the fight because they were women and not seen to be, you know, as influential as the male voices. And I think and actually I didn't know this, led to a huge split within the women's rights movement, because Lucy Stone and Susan B. Anthony ended up not being such great friends. And I think that there's this, and I think it also goes back to this conversation about intersectionality and how people have different identities that they often have to grapple with. And I think especially when you're talking about people whose identities tend to be not of the majority or not of those who are in power. So if you have, you know, an African-American woman, she's dealing with that dynamic of, okay, am I an African-American first or am I a woman first? And that was, if you look at the civil rights movement, there were a lot of women who were extremely influential in the civil rights movement that then lended their voice to the feminist movement of the 1970s, because there was this natural branching out of, you know, there was sort of this multiplier effect of discrimination that people are experiencing. And I think that is one of the bigger things that is going to, or has needed to be grappled with in the past. And I think is what is sort of coming out when we're talking about the Women's March and what impact that's going to have on American society as well, is that there's much more of a focus, I think, and I hope, on the ways that people of different identities are experiencing discrimination and how they intersect with each other.
You know, that issue of intersectionality is going to, I think, become really important to the shaping of the movement going forward. I think that we have an opportunity here that is unprecedented to really look across some of those boundaries and borders of different movements to bring people together in a unified way to figure out what is the core of all of this, which is the humane and equal treatment of all living beings. And I think that when we start looking at those things, start having those conversations, start going a little bit deeper, that may be the actual aspect of growth that is the most profound for all of us as we start to move forward. One of the things that I was thinking about is, as you're talking about exposing women, and when people start realizing that women are a threat, I mean, this is nothing new to any of us, right? The mm-hmm. reason that there was a subjugation of women, the fall mm-hmm. of Eve, and or when Eve was framed, as some of us like to say, and all of the stuff that kind of unfolded around that, where women were delegated to a lower position within society because people understood intrinsically what power women have. The burning times when women were burned at the stake as witches because they understood aspects of connection to the natural world and healing that were outside of the purview of the religious leaders at the time who wanted to have absolute control over the masses. So, you know, this isn't something that's just newly coming up. This is something that has cycled through before. So it's going to be interesting to see, how do we handle those things going forward? And how do we rise up to meet it on both sides?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because mm-hmm. it's not simply about looking at how others respond to women, but how do women mm-hmm. respond to the perceived threat to their own safety? Mm-hmm. How do they respond within the structure of these movements to the targeting of women that we anticipate is going to be coming down the road once people realize that the women are truly rising up together and mm-hmm. working through a lot of the social problems that have been set to the side. You know, I think that these discussions on intersectionality, these discussions on, you know, the protection of the rights of others is going to be really interesting as it unfolds. And I'm actually really excited about watching, witnessing, participating mm-hmm. in the unfolding of this movement. So do you see anything that may be different from how we've experienced this in the past? And what are some of the markers of difference that might actually have an impact on how this unfolds this time around?
Yeah. Well, I think that, not to be underestimated, and I know that none of you do, since we're on a podcast and it's modern technology and all that, but not to underestimate the power that globalization and technology brings to this new wave of protests and this movement that hadn't been there previously for this country and for many others. I think that the connectivity has been really wonderful for a lot of people, especially young people. Just the amount of information that we're all getting. I mean, a couple of decades ago, if the same thing was happening in Syria, and there are countless times, unfortunately, that there has been an absolute, I don't even know the word, just destruction of human life and so much suffering that the world has not been able to see as quickly as we've been able to see more recently with Syria, for example. The images that we've seen coming out of Syria have such a quick turnaround that it's engaging people and it's making people angry and it's encouraging people to get involved at rates that I don't think that we've ever seen before. And so that also has allowed for young people to be involved, which adds numbers. And on top of that, I think that there's just this, and maybe it's because I'm part of the, what I would identify as like the progressive community. I think that there's this exhaustion that people are so frustrated that we're having to protest kind of the same ideas over and over. Like, why am I still having to convince people that women should have equal rights? Why are we still fighting that battle? And I think that there, the fact that there are more voices, there are younger voices who are coming in who have different skill sets than those before. And there are also people who are interested in running for office. And there are more resources for people that are interested in running for office. I mean, there are a whole host of organizations that are focused on just getting women involved in running for office in the U.S. and globally. And so I think that what you're going to see is that there is, I mean, there's always the potential for there to be a movement and then there's nothing else coming out of it. But from what I've seen, people are mad. People are really, really mad about what's going on in this country and elsewhere and on both sides. And so I think, as I mentioned before, more people coming into positions of office and there being more conversations about intersectionality that allows people of different identities to be in positions of power and in positions of leadership, I think that you'll see a change in policies and decision making going forward. And it may take, you know, a few years for us to really get to that point, but I think it might be rocky for a few years, but I'm optimistic that it'll end up in a little bit longer, there being really a paradigm shift in how decisions are made, at least in this country, and who's making them.
I want to go back to something that you said at the very beginning of the show, which was around the idea that women join nonviolent movements because they are inherently more peaceful than men are. Now, what you said actually was that you don't believe in this, you don't think this is true. However, it is a myth that persists throughout our world. And I am curious, how did you come to this perspective and why do you think it's important to articulate to people in the context of presenting, say, a study on women and nonviolent movements?
I think that solutions to problems that are constructed around the idea that someone is inherently something it threatens to be very superficial. Personally, I think that women are amazing, one, most importantly. But I think that women are, you know, better at compromise. And I think that, you know, women tend to be, you know, more community oriented. And I don't think that that's something that is just sort of inherent to being a woman. Like, it's part of my DNA naturally with an XX chromosome that automatically means that I'm better at X, Y, and Z. Because there are a lot of women that prove us wrong. There are a lot of women who have been involved and instrumental in horrible atrocities and seemingly don't have that gene. Now, there's a lot of complexity to that because it's also about motivational sets. It's about experience. It's about perceptions. But I think, you know, there isn't a hard and fast rule about what women are and are not and what men are and are not, because there are also a lot of men that, you know, prove wrong this idea that men are inherently aggressive or inherently unemotional. I think that instead we've socialized, and this is globally, but I speak, of course, as an American and you know, in America, but I've definitely seen this trend globally, that men have to show that they're stronger in physical strength and emotionally. You hear this, the be a man, don't cry, don't show your emotions sort of thing, whereas women, on the other hand, are encouraged to be soft and gentle, and then there's backlash if women are not. So, you know, I think it's just a matter of what has been ingrained in us for so long. And I think that we need to recognize our mutual capacity to break through that, because we all experience human emotions, and to not allow the men the space to experience those human emotions, I think, is a disservice to men. And I think that not allowing women to be strong and assertive and intelligent without being perceived as whatever horrible name, you know, they call women who are, or, you know, undesirable or whatever it is, I think it does a disservice to the power that inherently lies within women as well. So I like to think of both genders as having, or all the genders as having, unlimited abundance of opportunities to be whoever they are based on their experiences and not be limited by some idea of what it means to be a woman. And I think that policy should not reflect any of those inherent, you know, arguments as well.
I think that you bring up such a valid point. I've just gone through an incredibly traumatic experience here where we've lost two young men in their 20s in my family within a week. And the ability to be able to express their emotions, to be able to ask for what they need, is something that many young men don't feel that they can have. They don't have the ability to do that without being shamed and ridiculed or being viewed as weak. And oftentimes this leads to destructive behavior, even amongst those who are most well-balanced, you know, momentary decisions to try to escape what they're feeling, and can lead to really tragic and dire consequences. And so this is critically important, and I think it's going to be part of an ongoing discussion. And we don't have a lot of time left. We're running out of time. So what is it that you think is the greatest takeaway from this study, and what does it lead us to going forward?
Well, I think the greatest takeaway, which most of us probably already know, is that there's enormous power that lies in groups that are often underestimated. And this isn't just true for women, but I think for a lot of groups, and I think that it's a call to action for us to pay attention to peoples and identities. It's a call to action for us to be paying attention to what's happening, and that the media might not be showing us, whether it be in the US or elsewhere. You know, are there groups that are typically underestimated or typically overlooked who are protesting against something? And is that a message that we need to be educating ourselves on? It doesn't mean that we have to agree, but I think knowing what is happening and being a part of that discourse, that's what makes our democracy stronger, as you mentioned. And there have been some things that have happened in the last few weeks that I'm concerned undermines our democracy. So I think all the more reason for us to be paying keen attention to that.
Well, Maria, it's been a pleasure and an honor having this conversation with you on Love and Revolution Radio. And I want to just remind the listeners that this is Marie Principe, who wrote a study called Women and Nonviolent Movements. And Marie, will you let the listeners know where they can track down this study besides our show notes, which we'll put the link in too, but where else they might find it and more of your work if they're interested?
Sure, absolutely. If you actually Google USIP Special Reports, it'll bring up a link that takes you to a list of their reports, and you can find mine on that site. It was published in December 2016, and they're ordered chronologically. And I am currently now with the Woodrow Wilson Center and doing research on the impact that women's leadership has and what we can do to promote more women's leadership. So that is where I will be for the near future.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us on today's show.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
I need you to be love, 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 love and revolution.
Thanks this week to our guest, Marie Principe, for her great, insightful commentary and also her work that she's been doing on this theme of women and nonviolent movements. Our theme song is Love and Revolution, with words and music by Diane Patterson and performed by Diane Patterson and Spirit Radio.
If you enjoyed this show, you might also enjoy the things that I post on my Facebook page, Sacred Instructions, which can be found on the Love and Revolution webpage and on the podcast. Love and Revolution Radio also has a new Facebook page, and you can look for us under Love and Revolution Radio. You can also reach us via the Love and Revolution page on Rivera Sun's website, www.riverasun.com. And we are Love and Revolution Radio on Podomatic, Stitcher, and iTunes.
For Love and Revolution Radio, I'm Rivera Sun. As our guest, Marie Principe, pointed out, women and nonviolent movements are shaping and changing our world. So listeners, take a look at the organizations and campaigns growing in your area and seek ways to include more women in these efforts by the time we talk to you next week.